Welcome to the Continuing Education webcast, New HIV Guidelines, with Dr. John Bartlett. This program is jointly sponsored by the Annenberg Center for Health Sciences and Claris Health. It is supported by an independent educational grant from Bristol-Myers Squibb. To receive continuing education credit for this activity, participants must complete the program evaluation and post-test, which can be found on the main activity page at the Body Pro.
So, welcome everyone. I'm going to talk about the DHHS, or the federal guidelines for HIV care, that were released as a new edition on December 1. These are available on the web at AIDS Info, the source of all the federal guidelines. And so what I'm going to do is try to highlight those things that have changed since the last version, which was probably about 6 months earlier. And we'll probably have another version not too deep into 2008. So this is the most recent edition. Let me give credit to the people that did the work. So these are the people that are on the DHHS panel. It's composed of about 25 people that do HIV care. And that's the majority of the people that are on the list. There are 5 community representatives, and there are 7 from various federal agencies like the FDA, the CDC, the NIH, HRSA, and so forth. The way we do, all these people have a 3-year term. All these people are on a conference call once a month. And various parts of the guidelines are distributed to somebody that agrees to chair a subcommittee that will update a section, and then they do it, and then the entire group reviews it on a conference call and a vote, and then eventually it makes its way into the final document, or the revised document, as it were. And so what I'm going to talk about are the things that have happened in the last 6 months that are now official. And what you see on the slide are the people that actually did the great majority of the work. So we'll start off with a question. Well, I can start my remarks by saying what you're going to see were the changes. The main changes were the issue of when to start therapy, and then we dealt with the new drugs, Maraviroc and Raltegravir. I put them into all the tables and whatnot. I talked about the tropism assay for Maraviroc use, or CCR5 inhibitors. And then we also dealt with the HLA-B5701 genetic test for susceptibility to abacavir. And then we had a lot of discussion about when to change therapy and how to change therapy and use of resistance testing. There is a separate committee that deals with pregnancy and a separate committee that deals with antiretroviral agents for children. I'm not going to dwell on those, but I do have one slide on the issue of pregnancy. Okay, so let's get started. This is the a polling question. It's a 40-year-old man who has recently detected HIV infection and a CD4 count of 400, and he wants to start therapy. And the question is, which of the following would be the clearest rationale for him to start therapy? And the options given here are a viral load of more than 100,000, HIV-associated nephropathy. His wife is seronegative, so he's a, quote, discordant couple. Or number 4, the CD4 count done 3 months ago was 480, and therefore the CD4 negative slope is pretty fast. And it turns out to be about 320 per year. So now I guess we all vote. Okay. Everybody got their votes in? I'm not seeing the answers. Am I supposed to?
So, Dr. Bartlett, the results that are in are about 30% said option 1, viral load greater than 100,000. 41% said HIV-associated nephropathy, 5% said his wife is seronegative, and about 23% said a CD4 done 3 months ago.
Hey, well, we really split the group, didn't we?
Yes.
Okay. Well, let me go over them. I'll tell you what the right answer is. According to the guidelines, the one that's on there that is, quote, right, and this is a judgment call, and there's not a right answer, but the one that's on the guidelines is an HIV-associated nephropathy. Everybody with HIV-associated nephropathy ought to be treated regardless of the CD4 count. Now, let's look at the others. Viral load of 100,000. We've sort of abandoned this as an indicator for early therapy on the basis of the work done from Case Western and a number of other places that have shown that the viral load really has very little correlation with the negative CD4 slope, and therefore thought that the CD4 count was the main driver of the decision and not the viral load. So that's kind of gone down a lot. It appears that the most important factor in the CD4 slope is really immune activation. And right now the theory, I think, is that much of that comes from leakage across the gut wall, and people are starting to talk about antisepsis agents. That has nothing to do with actually the guidelines per se, except the part on the viral load probably does. I think it's important to point out that that's not any longer thought to be a major driver, which is a quantum shift from the thoughts of several years ago. HIV-associated nephropathy is a clear reason to treat. Wife is seronegative, so that makes him a discordant couple. I think everybody that's hearing this would probably agree that having a seropositive partner is probably one of the highest risks, and that you probably reduce that substantially by heart therapy. And there are three studies. I don't know if Tom Quinn talked about them when he gave his talk. I talked to him about them. But there's one published in JADES, one that's been presented from Rakai, and a third that's been presented, and they all show that the probability of transmission is reduced by 80 to 98%. Not surprising, since the main driver of risk is the viral load. So my own view is that number three is also right. Number two is right. Number one is maybe very, very slightly right. And then number four is the CD4 slope. The reason I didn't like that is because there's so much noise in the CD4 count. So I gave you two values, a 480 and a 400, and the variation around either one of them is about 30%, so that I'm not sure we have any idea whether this person is going down or how fast this person is going down. 2 points on a curve that is so filled with noise probably wouldn't be legitimate. At any rate, so let's go on to one more. This, I'll apologize in advance. This is not a bad question, but not very well written by me. So I'll take the full responsibility. Patient has CD4 count of 400, just like before, has hepatitis B, that's surface antigen positive, E antigen negative, and that's supposed to be hepatitis B viral load. Is 10,000, which is high. So what is your best option? Okay, so here are the options. Bacavir 3TC and lopinavir, tenofovir, FTC, and efavirenz, 3TC plus entecavir, or PEG interferon. So those are the options, and the issue here really is this. What do you do with the person that has hepatitis B and HIV and either requires treatment for HIV, or requirement for treating hepatitis B, or the requirement to treat both. That's the issue that's being raised here, and of course it's gotten very complicated with the drugs we currently have for both diseases. So let's now vote. And Patrick, are you going to tell me how these come in?
Yeah, so they're coming in. It looks like a majority is saying choice two. We have over 50% that have chosen that, with about a quarter choosing choice one and a quarter choosing choice three.
Okay, so I think number two is the best answer. Number two, yeah, it gets us above the threshold to start therapy for HIV infection, but quite frankly, I think people on the committee really had the feeling that we should be probably try to make it as simple as possible and treat this person for HIV and hepatitis B concurrently. So number one is wrong. And it's wrong because 3TC monotherapy, so this is good therapy for HIV and it's bad therapy for hepatitis B co-infected patients, but because of the high rate of resistance to 3TC by hepatitis B, not HIV, but hepatitis B. So 3TC should not be used alone in someone that has chronic hepatitis B. And I think that's the point to make regarding this answer being wrong. The second one provides two agents active against hepatitis B and three agents active against HIV. They're both well-recognized good treatments for each disease, and quite frankly, this is would be the tactic I would take. Now, I think an obvious question would be, what would you do if the CD4 count was 800, not 400? In other words, not even in the neighborhood where people would recommend therapy. And then I think what you would do is you would say, we need a treatment that will be directed against hepatitis B without any activity against HIV. Now, how can we get that? We can't get it with one, obviously. We can't get it with two. Can't get it with three. Both drugs are active, but it's an inadequate regimen for HIV because it doesn't have enough clout. Entecavir is the new kid on the block for having activity against HIV. This was the study actually came out of Hopkins showing that entecavir has activity against hepatitis B as well as HIV. And actually, it was one of those really neat observations where actually a PA went to the who's doing doing hepatitis B and HIV care, went to the clinic and had a patient that was getting entecavir for hepatitis B, was not treated for HIV, and noted that the HIV viral load went down. And of course, entecavir was not supposed to be active against HIV. But it was a significant drop, and then went ahead and subsequently we had Bob Silicano and others measure it in vitro. It had activity, and then we found a patient and subsequently a second patient who had a 184V that emerged during entecavir therapy. So it not only had activity against HIV, but it also brought out an HIV resistance mutation. So entecavir for three and entecavir for four is wrong. Peg interferon would be the right answer if you wanted to treat for hepatitis B. Tobevibine would be another possible answer. I'm not sure that we would want to use that drug that way, but nevertheless, that would be another correct answer. But it would treat hepatitis B without touching HIV. So that's how I would read that one. All right, so here are the recommendations of the DHHS committee. What they have said is you treat for AIDS, you treat for a CD4 count that's less than 350. Now, remember what the old one was. The old recommendations were, the data were robust to show that treatment should be given when patients have a CD4 count less than 200. And then we took the 200 to 350, and we said that's a gray zone, and it should be, quote, considered. And a lot of people sort of took that to mean that you could treat it, but you didn't have to treat it, and a lot of people didn't get treated. And I think that's probably, of all the changes, that's probably the major one. But I think it reflects the spirit of what's going on in the field, and everybody agrees that we ought to be treating more patients earlier in the course, and I guess that's the bottom line of this slide, and it's got perhaps the most important point raised in the revised guideline, and it's reflected in the new European guidelines, and virtually all of the guidelines that have been published in 2007. Then there are three situations where you would treat HIV with a CD4 count of above 350, and that's pregnancy, HIV-associated nephropathy, and patients who require treatment for hepatitis B, the case I just gave. So I gave you two out of the three that were the exceptions, and both were patients that had CD4 counts of 400. And then there's sort of this waffling statement of you don't necessarily have to wait until it crosses the 350 threshold, and your AIDS providers, and therefore you know the obvious thing here. Nobody is saying, you know, if it's 380, don't treat, and if it's 340, do treat. You got to use some judgment here, and there's some noise in this test as well as in the CD4 count that's just as great. It's half a log in viral load, and it's 30% for the CD4 count. So there's a lot of noise in the test we rely on. But anyway, for this one, those are the statements that are made. It does say that the viral load may influence, and it says some experts in the field. So there's still people that talk about the viral load as driving this decision. Discordant couples was also mentioned. I think we're waiting for more of the studies. There's a bunch of those discordant couples studies that are being done in Africa, but I don't think anybody thinks that you're not going to prevent HIV transmission with treatment of people regardless of the CD4 count. Acute HIV infection is another situation where there is no consensus agreement. Nobody knows whether we should be treating or not treating. So those are the guidelines that were just published in terms of when to start. Now, I thought I would say a few things about that decision. Why is there so much weight now given to an earlier start? And I would have to say that, these telephone conference calls have 35 people on the line. I would have to say that when people started talking about starting earlier, that the starts are too late, there was a rapid consensus. I don't think there was one person that actually disagreed that we're starting people too late. There's also the thought that there may be a limited CD4 recovery. That's not necessarily etched in stone. There are a few papers on it. There is another paper from Europe that shows that the CD4 count may be, when it starts low, never stops going up, but the incremental gains after 4 or 5 years are pretty slow. The adherence demands are something that we thought were overpowering to a lot of patients that didn't necessarily have to start early, and of course we've now said that adherence demands are not the 95% rule that we used to quote all the time. We're a long way from that. Not something we necessarily want to wear on our sleeve, but something that I think there's consensus on. The regimens are much easier. They're strong and they're less toxic. Resistance was always a fear, continues to be a fear. I put stabilized maybe. Actually, in Europe, it's going down. In the United States, it's going up. But I think people would say that the rate of increase is not as great. Also, we're not running out of drugs. We've got a rich pipeline, and the PI data would suggest that the great majority of people who fail a PI-based heart with boosted PIs don't have resistance. So that may be a very important exception to something that we thought was etched in stone 5 years ago. Early treatment is supported by large cohort studies to possibly will prevent transmission, and I've already talked about that. One of the big surprises in the last few years are the non-AIDS related complications, heart disease, renal disease, liver disease. Seems to be progressive and more common in people that aren't treated. The non-OI complications, including malignancy. So I sought to expand on a couple of these. This is the Egger presentation from CROI, and it shows the median CD4 count in patients that had were part of cohort studies. It was 30,000 patients that were in these various cohorts. If you say that 200, you got to treat before it gets to 200, you can see nobody's really doing that very well, except for maybe Australia. In the United States, we're down. In Africa, they're way down, but of course, they're coming up now. But I think the point of the slide is that we're starting too late. We're discovering people too late. These are data from our own clinic, the Moore Clinic, and it shows the CD4 bounce after initiating therapy out to 5 years, out to actually 6 years. And what it shows is that the patients who are seen very late in the course may never get back a high CD4 count. Now, you know that this is highly individualized. You'll be able to quote a patient who had a CD4 count of 50 and now has a CD4 count of 800. We all have those. But these are the average, and you can see that they have reached a plateau. I think there are two caveats here. One is that it's inconsistent, that is, other studies have not shown such a flat curve after 4 or 5 years. But when they don't show the flat curve, they show very small incremental gains. The second caveat is that I'm not sure we know how many CD4 count, what CD4 count you need in order to be immunologically good or competent. Even the patients that have high CD4 counts may have holes, and we all know about these reports of CMB retinitis with a CD4 count of 500 after somebody's had a good immune reconstitution. And that's because of a hole in the stuff that came back. Anyway, this was another argument in favor of an earlier start. Then the big cohort from Europe, the UK collaborative HIV cohort, with an analysis of 30,000 patient years, has shown that the risk of going on to AIDS or death is a continuum. And the earlier you start, the better you are. So in other words, you can justify as starting at a CD4 count of 650 or higher, something that most people on the call probably would not endorse right now. And to be fair, what I would say is that these differences as you go down these strata that are very high, higher than we're recommending, are statistically significant, but they're statistically significant only because the denominator is so huge. The number of observations are so huge. And nobody has shown that this is necessarily cost effective. So if you start everybody when they have a CD4 count of 650, you can reduce the rate of AIDS and death. However, the number of events is relatively small. All that is to say that these big cohorts can achieve very powerful statistical differences, there's a bit of a problem in the way we interpret those simply because the numbers are so big. This is a SMART study, and it showed the thing that I think surprised everybody more than any other part of it. We weren't really surprised that progression and death was higher in those that had continuous therapy as to, compared to those that had discontinued therapy or structured treatment interruption. What was a big surprise was the difference in complications that are often related to the medicines, that is, liver disease, renal disease, and cardiac disease, including cardiac disease expressed in the form of a stroke, myocardial infarction, or the need for a bypass surgery. And that was statistically greater in those that had discontinuation of treatment rather than continuous treatment. And I think that has now all of a sudden attracted a great deal of attention in the field. And that is the cardiovascular disease, liver disease, and renal disease that is associated with HIV infection per se, and untreated HIV infection appears to be a particular risk or a significant risk. I picked this slide out. It's not necessarily in the guidelines, but I thought it was one of the more interesting studies that was presented at CROI. And it was from the DAD study, which is that huge database that is actually an attempt to look at cardiovascular disease. But here they looked at cancer. And on the left-hand side of the slide, what you see are AIDS-related cancer. That's Kaposi's sarcoma and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And that's not going to surprise anybody. What it shows is that the risk of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma or Kaposi's sarcoma is 175 times more common with a CD4 count of less than 50 than it is with a CD4 count of more than 500. Nobody's going to be surprised. What the surprise is on the right-hand side of the slide, and that is non-AIDS cancers. That's cancers like lung cancer, breast cancer, stomach cancer, colon cancer, those kind of cancers. And there, the risk ratio is somewhere between 15 and 20 with a low CD4 count. So I think the interest here is not only in the importance of treating AIDS to prevent that kind of malignancy. Again, the number of events is probably relatively small, but it also, one of the things that's really interesting about this is it gets the oncologists interested in what we're doing. So immune surveillance is now very interesting to cardiologists, to oncologists, and so forth. We also talked about some of the concerns before about adherence, and we had the 95% rule. That's a Patterson paper out of Pittsburgh, which said that a patient had to take 95% of their pills or they were going to have virologic failure. And then we had the concern about resistance, the long-term toxicities were unknown, and then the benefit of early therapy was not very well established. So the next slide kind of addresses those issues. The Patterson study was done with nelfinavir-based heart. We don't advocate nelfinavir-based heart anymore. We all have boosted PIs or an NRTI-based heart, and though there the rules for adherence are much, much different. Banksburg, who's been a good student of this, says that for NNRTIs, the requirement is that curve starts to go down in terms of continued success or loss of viral potency and resistance when adherence is reduced to 70%. And that accounts for the 70% that's on the slide. I don't want to tell a patient. I would never tell a patient, listen, you take 7 out of 10 of these pills and you're going to be okay. Would never do that, but I think it does change our mindset in terms of the demands of the regimens. Resistance right now in the United States, near as we can tell, is 6 to 16%. For recent seroconversions, it's usually around 15 or 16%. So it's going north. We don't like it, but we would say that it's not going as fast as we thought it would, and there are a lot of options left. The long-term toxicity, of course, now we got surprised with lipodystrophy. We sort of knew about the mitochondrial toxicity back in the early 1990s, actually, with AZT and then D4T. I think what I'm trying to say here is that it's not that we know these drugs are safe. It's the fact that we kind of know what to expect after at least 10 years of using them. And then finally, is the benefit of early therapy was not established. That's still true. And so why does nobody do a study to find out when we would start? The The study that was done of when to start therapy was ACTG-019, a famous old study done in 1987. It was started, and the issue has never been addressed since. One of the problems, there are a couple of problems and reasons that people don't do this. That is, randomize somebody to start when the CD4 count is 500 versus 350 versus 200 or something like that. The reason is that, first of all, it would take a huge database. It'd be a very expensive study. And the second is you would probably have an answer after studying it for 3 to 5 years. However, there's a great deal of doubt that it would necessarily be applicable at the time that the study stopped. In other words, you'd have an answer, but you wouldn't be able to apply it by the time you finish the study, because we'd have new drugs and new patterns of care and so forth. So we sort of, so far, kind of counted on the cohort studies to give us that answer. So it's impure science, but anyway, it's the best show in town. Okay, so now here is another question. The question is, a patient has newly detected HIV, has a CD4 count of 450, and has cryptosporidiosis. When should he start HARP? I'm not sure I like this question, but anyway, let's ask it. Should the patient, there's only two answers. So we're making the assumption that you're going to start HARP, and that's why I don't like it. I'm not sure it's clear that this man is not like 95% of the people that have cryptosporidiosis. They don't have AIDS and they get over it on their own. So quite frankly, I'm not sure that this patient should even be treated. So let's get by that and say we've decided to treat. And the question is now or 2 weeks from now. And Patrick, tell me how we're doing.
So we've got about 3/4 of the audience that are saying 2 weeks from now, and about 1/4 are saying to treat now.
Okay, now we're going to do the same question. Patient has newly detected HIV infection. And this is kind of ridiculous, so I apologize. The CD4 count of 450 is incompatible with HIV-associated cryptococcal meningitis. So let's get rid of the CD4 count. Let's not have a CD4 count. We have a patient who has AIDS, has cryptococcal meningitis, has not been treated, and the question is, when should he start HARP? Now or 2 weeks from now? This is a fine question without the CD4 count, and the previous one was a good question without the CD4 count. Okay, Patrick, how are we doing?
In this case, we have about 2/3 saying to treat now and 1/3 saying to wait 2 weeks.
Okay. So let me tell you what the panel said. We don't really have good data on this. There's a number of studies that are examining the issue. Mostly are about tuberculosis. The whole issue here is immune reconstitution syndrome. I'll tell you what the panel said. I don't think anybody has the quote right answer. What they said is that if you have an HIV-related complication and you can't treat it, then you ought to start HARP now. And the examples of that were cryptosporidiosis, microsporidiosis, PML, HIV-associated dementia, a number of complications for which HARP is probably the major therapy. And then, so in other words, this patient that had cryptosporidiosis, we don't have any way to treat cryptosporidiosis, so let's start HARP. The second situation is where we have good therapy for both HIV, the cause of the immune deficit that led to the disease, and we have antimicrobial treatment that can treat the complication. And the examples here were MAC, PCP, and cryptococcal meningitis. And there the recommendation was for a, quote, short delay. And the reason for the, quote, short delay is the hope that the anti-infective agent, the anti-pathogen therapy, would get rid of the microbial load enough so that there would not be immune reconstitution. This is in the guidelines. However, I would have to say, and I'll tell you what else. The guidelines for this part of it have to be in sync with the guidelines for the Opportunistic Infection Committee. Now, the Opportunistic Infection Committee, that's the one that's run by King Holmes, Henry Mazur, Connie Benson, or somebody else. But anyway, they're rewriting their guidelines now. One of the things the federal guidelines do is that everything that is in one guideline that is relevant to another guideline is shared with the two committees to make sure that they're in sync. So when I talk to you about hepatitis B and the decisions there, then we talk to the hepatitis B committee on the OI guidelines to make sure that we said something that made sense to them and would support what is in their document. So this one is commensurate with what we think will be in the OI guidelines, which are probably going to be available early in 2008. It's a massive document and timely because it's been needed to be updated for so long. At any rate, what they said was what's shown on the slide, and that is if you can't treat it except by getting back the CD4 count, then start treatment as quickly as possible. If there is a risk, a major risk of IRIS, then it might be good to have a short delay. And that short delay is usually, quote, it's not in numbers, but is usually conceived of to be about 2 weeks. In other words, this patient with cryptococcal meningitis would have a delay of heart, initiating heart, by 2 weeks. The patient that had cryptosporidiosis would start heart now. For tuberculosis, there's a bunch of studies, and they will have an answer to this. One of the best ones is being done in the Far East. There's about five of them being done in Africa, and that is nobody wants to start all seven drugs at once. The question is, do you delay for 2 weeks? Do you delay until the first 8 weeks of therapy is done? In other words, you have the induction phase over, can you wait longer? A lot of it depends on the CD4 count. We'll have the answer. Most of us have sort of obliged the 2 to 8 weeks on the base of the starting CD4 count. So if it's less than 200, then we go 2 weeks. If it's more than that, well, actually, if it's less than like 50, we go 2 weeks. And if it's 50 to 200, we may wait 8 weeks. And if it's above 200, then we may wait until they're finished altogether. At any rate, that's kind of a crude summary of where those overlapping guidelines stand. All right, now the next question is, a patient has a negative test for HLA-B5701. What is the safety of giving abacavir in terms of a hypersensitivity reaction? So these are judgment calls. Is it completely safe, or is it relatively safe? This is not a silly question. May sound like a silly question, but the real question is, you and I know that when you have a patient that's going to get abacavir, we spend a substantial amount of the office time telling this person about the abacavir hypersensitivity reaction and the fact that it can be serious, in fact, life-threatening. In fact, there's 19 deaths as a result of the abacavir hypersensitivity reaction. So the question is the new test make it completely safe or relatively safe? So how are we doing, Patrick?
We have 86% that have said it's relatively safe and 13% that say it's completely safe.
Okay. I would go with the majority. I think it's relatively safe. And I'll tell you why. The person that did the study, well, let me show the next slide. This is the study that I wanted to mention. The study that was done, that was presented at the International AIDS Society meeting in Sydney, Australia, was by Malal from Sydney, Australia, and he's the one that has been, sort of discovered this association, gets credit for it, and has a strong belief in it. And the study was the PREDICT study, and I think most of the people on the line know about it. And what they did was to, 1,660 patients were going to get a Bacavir, were tested or not tested. Half of randomized to get tested or not tested. And what they showed is that if you got tested and you had HLA-B5701 positive, then your risk of getting a hypersensitivity reaction was about 50%, and that could be confirmed with a skin test that's not commercially available. If you had a negative test, the negative predictive value was an amazing 100%, and that sounded like it was essentially a perfect test, going in the direction you would want it to go. In other words, if you had a negative test, you could use a Bacavir with complete comfort. And all of these were verified or not verified on the basis of a skin test. And that was the definitive test to say whether the genetic test for 5701 was valid or not valid. So when you went away from PREDICT, it sounded like this was a slam dunk. This was 100%. This is one of the more recent papers. It was just published in AIDS. And here's what it showed. This is their experience with a positive result. They actually gave a Bacavir to two patients that had a positive 5701. And both of them had a hypersensitivity reaction. The more interesting group is the group that was negative. So negative and got a Bacavir, they had 151. They had a suspected hypersensitivity reaction in 4. Now, you and I know that calling something a hypersensitivity reaction becomes fairly difficult in some cases. However, they did have one or two that had a positive skin test. And the positive skin test is supposed to mean that the genetic test didn't call it. Now, Malal says he's never heard of that. And he has offered a case of Australian wine to anybody that can find a positive test or a positive hypersensitivity reaction that is confirmed by a skin test and is negative by the HLA typing. So this would be one where he would have to pay off. I think the point I would emphasize is this. It's a damn good test. And I think the standard of care means that anybody that gets a Bacavir in 2007 or 2008 ought to have this test before they get a Bacavir. And that if they have a negative test, that it's almost certain that they will not get a hypersensitivity reaction. However, we can't say never. And there are a couple of exceptions, things that impressed scholars in the hypersensitivity reaction that they were real. And this happens to be one of those papers to support that contention. And that means that we still, so what the guidelines say is this. They say it's a good test, standard of care, do it. If you don't have access to it, it's all right to give a Bacavir. However, it's kind of become the standard of care. Even if you give it in the presence of a negative test, you should warn the patient about hypersensitivity reaction and all that we used to say. This, by the way, is the PREDICT study, and it shows the confirmed hypersensitivity reaction, those that got the test, zero. So this was what led them to conclude that it has 100% negative predictive value. For positive predictive value is about 50%. In other words, about 50% have that allele, but don't get a hypersensitivity reaction, even though they have it. I'm not sure we understand that, but quite frankly, the way this test is going is the way you would want it to go. That is, it tells you when you have to be nervous, and you may undertreat with a Bacavir in a very small number. Now, the other test that is reviewed by the guidelines is the tropism assay for CCR5, used by Maraviroc, now as the only CCR5 inhibitor that's marketed. And what they essentially said is, this is a test you've got to get if you're going to use a CCR5 inhibitor. It's far more common to have CCR5 exclusively in patients that are treatment naive, but of course the paradox is that that's not really a group that are candidates for therapy, at least not now. None of the new treatments were thought to be adequate for initial therapy, but that is not necessarily a done deal at the present time. But for patients who are more in need of salvage and could use Maraviroc, the probability that they will have exclusively CCR5 is about 50%. What's shown down here is kind of the variations in the test, and what it shows is that there is a bit of noise. This is an imperfect test, so maybe 5% of patients will be read as CCR5 only, but have X4 either as mixed or dual isolates. What will happen with those patients if they're treated with Maraviroc? Of course, we used to worry that that would bring out X4 virus, and that's true, it does. And we thought that bringing out X4 virus would make the disease more progressive, and that turns out to not be right. The more rapid progression seems to not be caused by X4, but as a product of the X4 virus. So we're not doing harm. We're not losing anything as a result of erroneous use of Maraviroc, except time. The resistance testing, what the guidelines have said now is that the patient should get the resistance test as soon as they enter care. So you may see a patient that's got acute HIV infection. Everybody would agree they ought to have a resistance test, whether or not they're getting heart therapy. You see somebody that's early in seroconversion or maybe a year into the disease and has CD4 count still of 800, you get a resistance test. And the reason is because the further out from the time of transmission, the more we're going to have resistance mutations in the quasi-species or the minority pool. We would not be able to tell it, and we would like to have that information, as much information as we can, when we go into therapy. So you can repeat it. That's optional, but to get it when it first comes out. Baseline resistance, something I talked about, 6 to 16%. Of course, the two that we see the most are the 184B and the K103. The K103N is the one that we worry about the most because it knocks out the class. And actually, in the Rockefeller study in New York City, it showed that in recent seroconversions, the rate of the 103N is now up to about 7 to 10% in newly seroconverted patients. In terms of following the introduction of therapy, one of the things that is mentioned in the guidelines, it's not considered a standard, but it is considered a good sage advice. And that is, when you start someone on therapy, to have them come back for a viral load test at 1 to 4 weeks. It ought to be down by one log. If it isn't, then that's a good time to get resistance testing because of possibly inadequate virologic response in bringing out a resistant strain. Now, a couple of other guidelines that I thought were interesting that have addressed the issue of what nucleoside pairs to go with. This is the IAS guidelines, they're still 2006. The DHHS guidelines, still 2006. The European guidelines, they're new, that's 2007. Swiss guidelines are 2007. WHO is 2006. Here's what I put on the slide here, and that is what nucleoside pairs are people using. And of course, all of these three are co-formulated. They're the lion's share of prescribing at the present time. And so that those are the three that are shown. And actually, all of the guidelines focus all of their attention, at least in the preferred category, on these three pairs. So IAS USA and DHHS had AZT3TC and tenofovir FTC. And then IAS USA had abacavir 3TC, and the DHHS guidelines didn't because of the hypersensitivity reaction, as simple as that. Europe and Swiss added the abacavir and 3TC. Actually, Swiss have only that as their only option. And I think that reflects the widespread use of the 5701 allele test that's now common use, in very common use in most of Europe and Australia. I think the United States is kind of slow in this. And then WHO is still on AZT and tenofovir as the major choices. A lot of that is driven by price. And then in terms of the third drug, so it's a nucleoside pair, and then we have got the DHHS guidelines and the IAS USA guidelines. For the NNRTI, we've had favarins on the base of a better toxicity profile, maybe a little edge in potency, but it's pretty close. IAS USA had both NNRTIs. And then the PI pairings, all of them so far have had boosted PIs, only boosted PIs. And the three that are on the DHHS panel are here. The Gemini study was not available, and that, of course, is the flagship for Imbrace or Sequinivir study. And the IAS did have that one on. Well, otherwise, they're pretty darn similar. And then for pregnancy, I mentioned that there's a separate panel that does this. For pregnancy, the recommendation now is either AZT3TC is the nucleoside pair, and you know why. It goes back to the old 76 stuff. As the drug that's been used the most in pregnancy and has a good track record and huge numbers. And then lopinavir boosted Kaletra. So that is the choice for pregnancy. Then there is the alternatives, and dinavir is still on the list, which is a little bit of a surprise. Then there's a category called limited data where they just don't have good pharmacology. And the big problem is the pharmacokinetics in the third trimester, and that's holding back some of these drugs. And then two drugs that are contraindicated, efavirenz, you know about that, for teratogenicity, and then nalfenavir because of the carcinogen found recently in the capsule, which has set it back in a way that you all know. So this is the scorecard right now for pregnancy. That's a separate document. And it's a very scholarly, very long document that adds to the DHHS guidelines in terms of having another dimension that covers that. So this is kind of the summary slide. It's the DHHS guidelines. When to start earlier, everybody wants to start earlier. Every guideline in the world that I know of is saying start earlier, WHO included. The new tests are the tropism assay for CCR5 inhibitors and the HLA-B5701. The two new drugs I didn't talk about, they're spread throughout the guideline in the updated tables. I always thought the tables were the best part of, one of the best parts of the DHHS guideline, because they're so useful at the bedside. Resistance test, get it as soon as possible in untreated patients. And for treated patients, get it while they're on treatment or within 4 weeks. And we say 4 weeks because we start to lose mutations at the end of 4 weeks. And the what to start, the what to start is not in the current document. It's going to be out in 2008. These are the new guidelines from the European AIDS Society. I just thought I'd mention these. Notice that the NRTIs are the two that I mentioned. They use AZT3TC and DDI3TC as alternatives. The third drug is shown here. I'm not sure why they have a tazanavir as an alternative drug. But nevertheless, the rest of it sort of resonates with what we've been talking about so far. And I think that's the last slide, so I'll thank everybody for listening and be glad to answer questions if we have some.
So, Dr. Bartlett, while we're waiting for questions to come in over the phone, we have a couple that came in over the web. The first is, do you think the results of the SMART study has effectively killed interest in treatment interruption?
I think it has. Whether it's a fair killing or not, I don't know. There's still the Staccato study being done in Thailand, which continues to... You know, the one thing that worried me about the SMART study is that, the good news was that it came out with such a clean answer their numbers, their statistics were very powerful in saying, you know, it wasn't a close call. You didn't need a statistician to tell you that it was. But the two things that bothered me about it were the fact that they waited until the CD4 count was 250 before they restarted, and most of us said we would restart at 350. So the way most of us did treatment interruption was different than the way they did it in the study. The second thing that bothered me was that they had huge numbers, 5,400 people that participated in that. And of course, you don't have to have a high frequency of an event to sort of drive the statistics so that it can make a very strong statistical statement on the basis of a relatively low frequency event. And what I don't know, and I can't get an answer to, is continuing therapy in everybody cost effective? I mean, they wound up with patients in the treatment interruption arm that were off of therapy half of the time. In other words, they spent half of their time off of treatment. So I think people are going to start to ask more and more questions. When we're given therapy, it costs $15,000 a year, and now we're talking about continuing it with uninterrupted for a lifetime, and that lifetime duration is starting to look longer and longer and longer. So I think eventually somebody's going to say, well, you can do that, but it's not going to be cost effective. But I think for most purposes right now, most of us in the clinic are going to say no more treatment interruption unless they are in some sort of a study.
We have a related question regarding the trend to start earlier and whether you think it will continue even possibly to 400 or count, CD4 counts of 400 or above.
I think that's a great question. I think you probably, it's strictly conjecture on my part. I expect you probably will. I think we're going to see more and more enthusiasm about, you know, when you think about it, I mean, what other disease that's serious and potentially lethal disease do we have in the field of infectious disease where we have good therapy, really good therapy, and we say, well, we're not going to treat right now. We're going to wait until they have more disease before we start therapy. I mean, the precedent just is not there. So I think the answer to the question is we'll probably be treating earlier and earlier. The big question that a lot of people are going to ask, and I think it's a fair question, is what is the cost effectiveness of treating somebody with a high CD4 count? And see, we can get the numbers. We can get the numbers. The North American cohort that's under Richard Moore now has 75,000 patients in it. It's huge. And the ability to answer a question in that is just awesome. However, I guess the second part of it is what I raised before, and that is it cost effective to do that? Okay, so what else do we have here? We got quite a few. We got some good questions. Is there any particular reason we've been so slow to adopt HLA testing in the United States? I don't know why. I thought we should have started doing this 2 years ago or 3 years ago. So I'm surprised that the United States didn't start earlier like the Europeans have. Usually we start things much before Europe does in HIV care. This is one where I think we were slow. However, having said that, I think now when I go around to clinics, I find almost everybody is starting to do this and do this quite frequently. It's commercially available, costs about $100, takes about 10 days or 2 weeks to come back. It comes back as a yes-no answer. It's a very good test for what it's intended to do. For those who are diagnosed with a questionable history of a baclofen hypersensitivity, does emergence of the new genetic test allow us to revisit? Yeah, I think it does. I think it does. I think there were an awful lot. You know, one of the interesting things was that that ACTG trial that had a baclofen 3TC and AZT as part of the, as one regimen, and AZT 3TC as another, it turned out that the frequency of a baclofen hypersensitivity was the same in the group that didn't get a baclofen as it was in the group that did get a baclofen. And that's not going to surprise people that do this work. And I think what it shows is that, yeah, we see a lot of bad things, and we're very sensitized to a baclofen hypersensitivity reaction. And I think this question's a really good one. If you have a patient that had a hypersensitivity call and it doesn't necessarily feel real good, and you feel like you really need a baclofen, I think I would get the test and then give it under observation. That's what we always did before when we had these confusing patients. One thing you can say about baclofen hypersensitivity reaction, every time you gave the drug, they got a worse reaction, and it was progressive, so that if they didn't have a reaction, you couldn't say, you would have to say you don't have it. How is Maraviroc going to be used when most clinics can't afford the tropism test? Very good question. Sticker price on the test is $1,960. It's tough for a lot of places. There are some ADAPs that have agreed to buy it. The one in my state, Maryland, has not agreed to buy it. They don't want to offer that test. They say ADAPs are for drugs, not tests. So some places will have an ADAP that'll do it. Some third parties will do it. Some won't. I think if you can't get the test, you can't use the drug. I think it's as simple as that. And it is quite checkered as to who will be willing to pay for the test. I expect that 6 months from now it'll all be worked out. But right now we're in the transition zone. Only two labs in the world can do it. The one that we usually use is the test out of California. The cost is about $1,960, as I mentioned. It does have a bit of noise in it that I mentioned, but it's not hard to interpret the results. I mean, it comes back R5 or X4R5, and it's not hard to read their answer. What is a bit of a problem is a little bit of false positives for X or for R5 only, not the other way. Are there going to be dramatic changes in the guidelines regarding what to start with? I don't know what the panel will do. I can't answer that. I personally it wanted to show the European guidelines because I think that's sort of the reflection of the field. It doesn't necessarily mean the DHHS guidelines are going to be the same, but I think people are excited about some of the new drugs. I think the new NNRTIs that are going to probably get marketed next year, Raltegravir and Maraviroc, are generating a fair amount of interest. Darunavir did awfully well in the Artemis study against Lopinavir. There may be some modest changes, but when you come to new drugs, a lot of people have said it's got to be a big victory in order to get me, say Dr. Joe, to want to use them in first-line therapy, because what we've got now is working awfully well, and we've had these drugs for 5 to 10 years, and we know all of their pocks. So I think I'm not sure that if you ask me right now, I would guess that there's not going to be a lot of big changes, but there will probably be changes. Notice that reading the new guidelines, there is nothing new regarding treating lipoatrophy. Yeah, I think we've said all we can say. I mean, that part of the document, by the way, is going to be done over again. So that part has not been revised, and that is the part about drug toxicity. But if you think about what's going on in the field, I mean, except for avoiding the drugs that cause lipoatrophy, which is something we can talk about, for people that already have it, I think we know that stopping D4T or DDI or AZT, if they're responsible, is slow and painful, painful only because it is so slow. And I expect that that's going to be the major change, and then the other is going to be plastic surgery. I'm just reflecting our own practice here in the Moore Clinic, not anything on behalf of the DHHS panel. And that's pricey, and our insurance companies will not pay for an iatrogenic complication. So plastic surgery is a bill. And those things cost, I don't know what it's costing out in the rest of the world, but for us it's about $2,000 an injection, and most of the patients require 2 to 5 injections. So it's pricey, very pricey. I notice the guidelines, there's no upper limit regarding what CD4 count to start ART with discordant couples. Is this to get their viral load undetectable to prevent transmission? Yeah, I think that's exactly it. I think the goal with a discordant couple is to protect the uninfected partner. And I think someone on the line could say, listen, you don't have to expose somebody to all that high-powered therapy with the risks and so forth if somebody would just use condoms. And I think that's a very valid criticism. But nobody's had very good luck in getting uniform compliance with condoms. You find individual exceptions, but you don't find population-based use of condoms on a regular basis. So for some people, it'll be important. That is early therapy. Other people, it will not. And I would also emphasize the fact that the guidelines did not come down strongly on that point. They mention it as one of the issues to think about. In the person that has a CD4 count above the threshold, where we start because of the threshold. I think we've answered all of these questions. Are there any on the phone?
No, doctor. There are currently no questions on the audio portion.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks.
Thank you for listening. To take the post-test and receive CME CE credit, please visit the Body Pros main activity page.